Welcome back in. College Golf Talk has returned. It is 2024. Steve Burkowski, Brentley Romine with you. It's been too long, my friend. Hope the holidays treated you well and that you're excited as college golf's underway. Even though it's February 1st, the spring season, as we like to refer, we're off and running. We've got results and the countdown to California underway for the national championships.
It's been way too long, Burko. It's been, gosh, what, almost 3 full months, maybe 2.5 months since we've met on this podcast, and you've gone and turned into a college basketball play-by-play announcer. How has that been? I feel like maybe we should rebrand the pod College Golf in Basketball Talk.
Loved it. Loved it. Was able to call a handful of games. Iowa, Nebraska, had an Atlantic 10 game a few weeks ago. Thrilled at the opportunity and spread my wings a little bit. It makes sense, right? We're under the Peacock umbrella. Show all those true colors in the college world. But enjoyed that. Thrilled to be back. And the story, in my opinion, 2024, in the entire world of golf, a couple weeks ago on the PGA Tour at the American Express, Nick Dunlap, University of Alabama sophomore, a winner. First amateur to win in 33 years on the PGA Tour, was thrilled to be there and see it firsthand. And the man that has seen it front and center for the better part of 2, 3, 4, 5 years, depending on when golf camps were in Tuscaloosa, to the success he's had for the Crimson Tide, JC Well, the head men's golf coach at Alabama, joining us. Always good to catch up, my friend. And I think we got to get you on the payroll here for all the appearances on all the platforms under our umbrella you have blessed us with over the last couple of weeks.
Well, first, you're very kind. I'll get my wife on that. She's my agent, and I kid. No, it was an incredible week. And Burko, I can't thank you enough for all you did during the tournament and the kind words and everybody at the Golf Channel. And Brentley, with you know your stories and all. It was a special day and a special weekend and one we're still reveling in around here today.
Yeah, couldn't do it without you, my friend. No doubt about that. We appreciate those sentiments. But let's go back to the flight early Sunday, to me interviewing you at the turn, to everything now that you've had some time to sort of settle in. What has that been like for you? And then the decision-making for Nick Dunlap to, while it hurts you, kind of a no-brainer from my perspective that you have to turn professional. How have these last 10 to 12 days been for you?
Very crazy. You know, you don't prepare for things like this. You know, you say every day you wake up, something different may happen, and it has. But, you know, it was an incredible opportunity, and I'm just glad I made it. I'm glad we made the decision. And we were practicing down on the coast when Nick was 5 under through 7, I believe, on his third round on his way to shoot 60. And we were working and playing and just got finished playing. And we had it on the Golf Channel telecast while we were eating lunch at the club down there. And I looked at the guys and I said, guys, I'm feeling conflicted because we're practicing, but I think I need to go. And they said, Coach, you need to go. And so I got in my car and just started driving home. And it's about a 5-hour drive. And so I wasn't going to get home until about 8 or 8:30. I have no flight. I have no idea how I'm going to get there. And so basically I booked a flight on my phone while I was driving. And if you've ever driven from the coast to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, it's not interstate. And so I'm thankful that I made it home. I didn't run into any deer or also run off the road trying to get a flight. And I got a flight first thing in the morning Sunday. And so, you know, airlines are airlines, and you know, travel's travel. And so just hoping I could get there because I was already going to get there after the round started, and so any delays was going to make it crazy. But it worked out perfectly. Got to you guys, you were kind, we got a ride out there, and by the time I got there he had just birdied the fifth hole to go 1 under on 5, and so made it in time to kind of watch when all the drama really started happening right there on that tee shot on 7.
Yeah, it was enjoyable. Glad it all went as well as it could. These days, hopping on planes and connections, But let's sort of go post-tournament. We've reveled in all the emotions and the celebrations. What were the days like after when Nick withdrew from the Farmers to sit with his family, his teammates, you as a coach? What advice did you impart to him of what entailed his decision-making? Because ultimately it was up to Nick.
Yeah, it was real quick. You know, I flew out Monday, got a text from him. I'm dropping out of Torrey Pines. And I get it. It just shows the maturity of me. So I want to come home and talk. And so got home, I guess, you know, late Monday, and met with he and his family Tuesday morning into lunch. You know, met with Nick individually for about an hour and a half, just to talk about things. What was, you know, what was in front of him? What was he thinking? What were his gut? And then we had a meeting with he and his family for about an hour after that. And we already had a team meeting set up for 1:30. This was not an impromptu one. This was one we were going to have as a team. After I left, I said, let's just get back together at 1:30 on Tuesday and we'll talk about practice and things like that. Well, it turned out to be more than that. And so we, you know, talking with Nick and his family, what was in front of him, and you could feel the current was pushing him towards being a pro. That was what the talks were. But to Nick's credit, he has not told anybody yet that he wanted to turn professional. He wanted that to be his teammates in that meeting. He didn't even tell me privately that I'm turning pro. It was really, you know, these are the things that were in front of me. I feel like I'm leaning towards doing that. It wasn't until the private meeting when we gave him the floor in the meeting that he had a chance to say what his intentions were. And to me, I just think that just shows the special young man he was. You know, he could have turned pro hit Torrey and just hit the ground running. You know, he was already down there. He's already in the tournament. He's already got his PGA Tour card. And he chose to fly home and tell his teammates. You heard him during y'all's telecast and also during the post game that this decision affected more than just himself. It affected him, you know, with family, his teammates, us, the University of Alabama Golf. And to his credit, he took time, thought it was selfless who he is, and came and really wanted to work through with his teammates. And I'm being honest, I think if in that meeting the teammates would have felt like he was abandoning them, I think he would at least, I don't know if he would have not turned pro. I think he would have, it would have been a long meeting, but the, you know, how he handled it and then how we handled it, and Cannon had a special moment in there because he was almost apologetic, and Cannon really just said, please don't apologize. This is a chance of a lifetime. You're turning pro, we're turning pro with you. We're doing this as a team. And I really thought that, you know, meeting, there were a lot of tears. There was a lot of emotion. I'm very proud as a coach that we have a team like that, and that our leadership, we have a very senior oriented team that was very complimentary and positive toward what Nick wanted and needed to do, which was to turn professional.
Now, he's obviously debuting today as a pro on the PGA Tour AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am. Can you give us a little scouting report on what we might see from Nick this season and his game and your expectations as he enters this new chapter in his life?
I expect him to hit the ground running. I think he's that good. I think he's that prepared, and I think he's mentally that strong. You know, this is the weather's going to play a tremendous amount this week. But it's not a bad tournament to start in. You don't have in a cut, so he doesn't even have to think about things like that. He just gets to play. But I expect him to be, you know, part of this PGA Tour that people are going to talk about, not just because he won last week, but because what he's continually doing. I think he's that good. I really do. I think he actually has a chance to be a long-term star on the PGA Tour. And so I look forward to seeing what is in front of him. Golf's a hard game. He's playing against the best players in the world, but I know he's not intimidated by that. I know his game is good enough to be around them day in and day out. I think he showed that at Amex but also, I, like I said, I would not be surprised if we're not talking about what he's about to do, not what he's done.
Mm-hmm. Strokes gained is a big data point or set of data points on tour. Where do you think he slots in kind of in each of those facets right now? Maybe not his potential or what he could do, but where do you think he kind of fits in right now as he's a 20-year-old now playing with the big boys?
I think there's three things, the reason I believe he'll be successful. First, he hits it far. that's, you know, I think that's a data point that's obvious. He is pretty straight too, but he has enough speed and enough power to play with the big boys because he is a big boy. And I think that's only going to get better and more. He's just 20. Second, he's an incredible wedge player, an iron player. So his proximity is going to be, you know, which I, you know, is probably the number one stat on the PGA Tour for success. And then the final thing is, you know, when we talk about putting and we always, you know, is a debate as putter, you know, as a putter, I still think it's what sets apart winning and losing. Maybe not from a statistical point of view, but, you know, you have to be able to make the putts. And I think he's already been a tour putter since he was a teenager. It's probably the most underappreciated part of his game by people outside of around here. I think he's a phenomenal putter. I think he displayed that during the Amex. And that wasn't just a hot week. I think it's his best club in his bag. So I think the three things of the game line him up to be very successful on the PGA Tour for years to come. And then we haven't even really, there's no strokes game for how you think. That intangible, he's off the chart also.
I always say he's, you know, 20 going on 45 just mentally. I think maybe physically as well. I mean, there was a couple revelations, I think, during his press conference last week where he said he threw out his arm playing Down the Clown at Dave and Buster's before the semis of the AM, ruptured his eardrum. Is he a little bit like Humpty Dumpty? And what has it been like this last three semesters, you know, kind of dealing with the little bruises and scrapes that he's gotten? And thank God he's at Alabama. I mean,
well, you're kind. Thank you. Yeah. Probably the one thing we promised, you know, he had a hurt wrist before he came, and he went to a lot of specialists, and it's, you know, to promise health is going out there, but I do trust our medical team, our trainer. He's given a lot of credit to our trainer, Clark Holter, to getting him to where he is. And so we promised him that in recruiting. I let other people promise money and things like that, or you're going to play or whatever. It's the only thing we really actually promised him was we're going to get you healthy. And if you're healthy, then you're going to be Nick Dunlap. And so, yes. So we did do that. The part the part you were talking about, the eardrum and the hurt shoulder at the AM is also what I'm proud of. You know, he is an old soul, but after his first semester here, he came up and said, for the first time, I feel like I'm a kid. You know, he kind of grew up around an older generation. He played with older people at Greystone and things like that. And so when he got here, kind of became a kid. He busted his eardrum, jumping off a rock at the lake with his teammates. And so, you know, that's what kids do. That's what young people do. And, you know, he's playing Dave and Buster's to relax and to get away. And so I actually was proud of that because I want our players to be, you know, to enjoy the spot they're in. I don't want them to be 20 and feel like they have to be 40, or they need to be 20. And so though they were things that probably make other people upset, you know, we just, you know, embraced it and said, okay, that's what a 20-year-old does. You know, Hunter wasn't very happy that he busted his eardrum because we wouldn't let him fly on the private flight because we didn't know about a thing. So he had to go down the car. We had to rent him a car and drive 8 hours. So there you go. So Hunter's the one who paid more for his things than Nick did, for sure.
That's all the positives, the support he's gotten from you, Hunter, the rest of the team over the last year and a half. But now the reality for you on February 1st, one of the best college players in the game is no longer part of your lineup. What impact does that have beyond the obvious as you try to gear up for the next 3 months?
Well, that's the elephant in the room, no pun intended here. But, and, you know, after Tuesday's team meeting, I gave our guys, the weather was, you know, we had a lot of rain. It was a lot of rain in the forecast. And I gave them off all the way till Monday first for all of us to kind of soak in what's going on. You know, Nick had a press conference on Thursday, and I said, we're going to regroup at 7:30, at 9 o'clock, Monday morning for a team meeting and all. And so all of us kind of needed to take it in and try to figure out what we're going to do moving forward, especially me as a coach with our guys. And some of the guys went down to Florida and practiced, our graduates did that, and some just stayed here. And so, that's a great question. You know, we're in day four of that, but I know we hit the ground running on Monday of, who are we going to be? You know, we're not going to talk about what we could be, and that doesn't matter anymore. Who are we going to be? And, you know, we won our last tournament in the fall at Steelwood against some pretty good teams. You know, I think Chattanooga is a very good team. It's well coached. And we won that tournament without Nick in the lineup. We kept him out of the lineup because of he was fatigued from Abu Dhabi playing on the World Am. And so we had had some things that we could at least focus on. You know, we had basically played a tournament, prepared for a tournament, and he was, you know, gallivanting around right now playing tour golf anyway. And so we were already kind of ready for this from a he's not in the room point of view. Now, you're obviously correct. We're not going to, you know, take his score. But how do we become a better team without him? How do we work together? I think the biggest thing we wanted to talk about was we weren't going to try harder. I think if we were trying hard, that means we weren't trying properly the first time. And so I think those are the things we talked about. We've won without him, and that was really cool. And it gives us a little bit. And how then do we maximize, you know, our talent and what we have in front of us? We're very old, which I think helps us. You know, we have a lot of seniors. Four of our, you know, top six guys are fifth year or fourth year seniors. And so I think that helps. And in the end, my job and our message is, what, if he was here, what would we do differently? We would try to be the best we could be. And so we're not going to lose any, you know, we're not going to try to do anything different than what we're doing. We're just going to try to get better because that's what we're supposed to do every day. If Nick was here, that's what we would do. If he, since he's not here, that's what we're going to do. And we're just going to stay to that mantra. And we're in it. We're a pretty good team. With the players we have with Cannon and Thomas Ponder and Jonathan Grizz and JP Cave and Austin Coggin, those guys have helped us tremendously in the fall and in their past. And I think we have a chance to, if we rally together and do the right things every single day, to still be a good golf team.
Jay, I think us at College Golf Talk, we rank the Alabama big time departures. One, Nick Dunlap, and then you go down a little ways to number two, Nick Saban. That's just how we roll and operate here. I remember having Florida State coach Trey Jones on a couple of years ago, maybe a year and a half ago, and he shared a really cool Bobby Bowden story about how Coach Bowden used to drive his car up on the driving range. And one day the GM or the owner of the club was like, hey, you need to tell Mr. Bowden that he can't be doing that. Because he wanted the AC, wanted to kind of pop in his car and then go out, hit a few balls and go back in the car. And Trey goes, you know, I will go and ask him if he wants anything to drink, if he wants me to give him a tip, but I am not telling him to move his car. Like, that was just a thing. Do you have any stories? Because I know Nick has probably spent a lot of time at your guys' facility, hitting balls, kind of talking with the guys. What's the definitive Nick Saban Alabama golf story?
Well, I have a lot, actually. He very similar to Coach Bowden. He loves to come and hit balls here in the spring. After, you know, usually right after spring ball. And so sometime in April, he starts coming here every day and hitting balls late in the afternoon. You know, the sun stays out a lot longer. So 5 to 5:30, coach would start showing up, hit balls. We're on the way. We're only about a couple of miles from his house from here anyway. And so this is where his first stop before he went home. And so he'd always do it. One of my favorite stories was we were having golf camp. And this is 1st of June. And I think we had just won the national championship. So there's a lot of euphoria around here anyway. And literally we have kids lined up. We probably have 75 kids this year at camp and they're just lined up hitting balls and we got them in the putting and the chipping. And he texted or called and just says, do you mind if I come out and hit balls? I said, we do. We just got golf camp. You might want to come out. We break for, you know, for lunch. I mean, for dinner, supper around 5:30. I can't remember what I told him. And so I thought he would come out after that. Well, he came out at like 4:30. And so there's this line of kids hitting balls from the ages of 10 to 17 years old, hitting balls. And on the end of them, literally, he just pulled himself up and plopped his bag down, and he's hitting right in the middle of them. He didn't go off to the side of the range. And at first, the kids had no idea who it was because they were busy doing what they were doing. And then all of a sudden, they just all looked up, and there's Coach Nick Saban is in the middle of golf camp. You know, hitting right beside all these kids. And of course, every kid went to every phone and is now doing this selfie here and there or whatever. And so That's just who Coach was. He doesn't care. He just was like, you know, he didn't go off on the side and get away. There was a empty slot of balls, and so he's right beside 12-year-olds at camp hitting balls. I think he wanted a lesson is why he really actually did it. But, it's one of the cool things that ever happened, you know, around here is because in the end it went from everybody hitting balls and then nobody was hitting balls but him, and everybody's got their phone out videoing him hitting balls. So it was a pretty cool moment.
And the kicker is one of those kids was Mac Jones.
Probably. For sure. It'd be funny. Look back and see some old Instagram and find out who was there, because Dunlap could have been here, to be quite honest with you, because he came to camp 10, 11, and 12 years old.
Jay, we could do an hour with you. We could do a whole week of podcasts with you, stories. Always good to catch up. Can't thank you enough for everything you've done for us through the past few weeks, the past couple of decades for me, and hopefully it will continue for a long time to come. You're one of the best in the business, and your insight on Nick Dunlap and Saban, for that matter, invaluable. Love having you aboard.
Well, I appreciate you guys. Y'all make college golf better, and I think something from what Nick did, I think college golf has a brighter future, and you two really do make it a better. And so as a golf coach in college, I really appreciate what you guys do.
Likewise, my friend, all the best moving forward. Look forward to keeping an eye on the Crimson Tide throughout the spring season.
Great. Roll Tide.
Thank you,
Jay. JC. Well,
Venmo request is on the way. Yeah.
One of the best in the business, 2-time national championship coach at Alabama. Great insight. We could literally go an hour or two or three, and Nick Dunlap's gone. Top 70 player in the world. Going to make a lot of money. Well-deserved, well-earned. And it's changed the dynamic a little bit for their team. So it's going to be intriguing to see how they get through to the other side. But it won't be for a lack of effort. But he's not the only SEC player, a standout, an All-America selection, going to professional golf. We're losing two of the very best, Brentley.
You know, Caleb Surratt is, I think if you had Nick Dunlap, Gordon Sargent kind of on the top of the big board, the Mel Kiper big board, I think we, in college golf, maybe we can call it the Steve Burkowski big board. But if Nick Dunlap and Gordon Sargent were 1-2 in that, Caleb Surratt might be 3. He could be 4, maybe behind Michael Thorbjornsson. But a huge loss for him to go to LIV Golf. And this has been something that there have been rumblings for the last few weeks. Rumors that he had moved out of his dorm, had dropped out of school. So this is something that I think people had been expecting, and it kind of made its way like wildfire around college golf, but made it official on Wednesday. He's joining the Legion, I keep wanting to call it Legion, but Legion 8, John Rahm's team, with Tyrrell Hatton and Kieran Vincent, who fans of college golf will know him from just a few years ago playing at Liberty, part of those good Liberty teams with John Yon and even before that, Mickey DeMorant, Gabe Blench. But it's one of those things where we really haven't seen too many amateur defections. And that was something I thought when LIV initially started and they were having trouble getting some of the top tier guys, I thought they were going to really lean into the young players and the amateurs and try to get these guys before they have any sort of guarantee on their careers, right? Because there's a lot of unknown, and PGA Tour U is still kind of in its infancy then. And since then, I think that program has made it a lot tougher for these amateur players to want to leave the PGA Tour umbrella and get out of that program, because there is a lot of opportunity there, as we've seen with Gordon and Ludwig Ober. And so I initially thought that we could see more amateurs going, but we had David Poos, Eugenio Shikara, and that was really it. I think now Caleb Surratt kind of reminds everyone, like, hey, yeah, we're still coming off this euphoria that is Nick Dunlap winning on tour as an amateur and accepting PGA Tour membership and all this stuff. But a top 10 amateur just went to LIV. Like, who's to say we don't have a couple more? So I don't know. I'm optimistic that, when all the dust settles, when all of these negotiations kind of calm down with the tour and potentially the PIF, and once we figure out kind of where golf is moving forward, I just hope that it you know, maybe shines the spotlight a little bit brighter on amateur golf and just how good these guys are. But if things stay the same, I would not be surprised if we do have another Caleb Surratt like amateur go to LIV, you know, next season if there's a spot open.
Yeah, everyone's situation is different. As you said, so many moving parts in terms of two different buckets. Does it become one bucket? Well, we'll have to find out. But
what's a bigger loss, you think? Dunlap or Surratt?
Ooh. You'd have to probably say, Nick, you win the Junior Am, you win the US Am, you're a tour winner. It's no knock on Caleb. Put him 2 years ago or put him 2 years later, he's maybe one of the top three as opposed to one of the top five or 10. So splitting hairs on that front, at least in my opinion. But
I think
as you
it's
said,
relative was, Tennessee, like relative loss could be
Tennessee.
Yeah, it's
a way to look at it.
As Jay said, they have Cannon Claycomb, Thomas Ponder. They had the experience there. I know Tennessee has Bryce Lewis, but I don't know, especially for a Tennessee team that has struggled to get to the NCAA championship the last 2 years. I think, you know, we could look back in a few months and say, wow, Caleb Surratt loss was a lot bigger.
Yeah, from that perspective of the impact to the team, yeah, I'll lean with you there. Quick recap. I know you're out at Vegas, coaches convention, trying to grasp the rankings. Give us the 2 minutes Cliff Notes version of what happened and maybe how close are we to having everything in place.
Yeah, I know that this podcast, and I guess maybe more so me, has taken quite a bit of run at the rankings. And some of it, like many coaches probably will admit, is just out of frustration that we went from a system in an environment that wasn't really broken with Golfstat, and now all of a sudden everything's in chaos. And honestly, Mark Brody just kind of got thrown into the middle of it. But after being at convention, after seeing the dedication by Professor Brody to be available those 2 days. I mean, he spoke for probably 2 hours total in front of the room and then stayed for eight total hours the 2 days to talk with coaches one-on-one and kind of explain things. And I sat in on some of that. We had a little bit of back and forth. And I will say that I think, look, going forward, I do believe that this is a ranking that is going to work. In layman's terms, it's easier to understand. I mean, there's a lot of intricacies that no one's really going to know how to compute this ranking off the top of their head. Or if you throw them a calculator, they can't do it. But I think in layman's terms, it's essentially, you know, it's what you're expected to do in a tournament. It's how tough the field is. It's how much you end up beating teams by in your strokes game for that event. All that kind of factors in and you get a point number. I will say there have been some kind of things that jump out with smaller field events and match play. I know people had an issue with that, but I do believe that once we get more events in, once we get to March, early April, and we have a lot of data to kind of use, this will be a pretty good ranking and a pretty accurate ranking, I think, to go off of. I already think it's fairly accurate. You can make a case for some examples here and there, but I do think it's going to end up being a good thing for all the, you know, kind of all the maybe negativity and unknown from a few months ago. I do feel a lot more positive. The one thing to answer your question further that I think came out of the convention is a need for standardization in college golf. There's no kind of ifs, ands, or buts about it, but college golf can't keep going down the wild, wild west format that they've had, where you have stroke play and match play and 6-count 4, 6-count 5. I think all that was fun, but as you're looking forward and trying to get more exposure and more fans and make it easier to understand, there needs to be some sort of standardization. And maybe you have a few days, as coaches were talking about, where you play, you know, foursomes and different types of things, but there needs to be at least a certain minimum number of teams in a tournament. You need to play 75 or 85% of your schedule stroke play 5-count 4 in at least 2 rounds, preferably 3. And even Professor Brody said this when I think it was Scott Schroeder from North Florida asked him, well, are the rankings more accurate if you have more of a standard format? And he said, yes. And so I think hearing that, that just shows that, you know, we can't keep going down the road we are with, you can play whatever the heck you want. And then it's up to Brody or whoever or the committee to decide like who's ranked where. I don't think it works like that.
Yeah, there's always going to be moving parts. It will be a struggle when you make what I will call a dramatic change. You know, even though it might not look like it, you have one entity who did it for 20, 30, 40 years, and now you've got a new entity. It doesn't matter how smart somebody is. It's like, okay, this is a different set of ingredients in this recipe. Where I'll be intrigued as we're starting to ramp up spring here in the next couple of weeks, as we get closer to March and April and regional rankings, and invariably somebody will say, gosh, we're 68th and we should be 57th in the new system or the old system. You know what I mean? It's that's where an onus, I think, the committee or whatever powers to be that are actually in that room need to go beyond the rankings. And, you know, in certain situations, not like, oh, okay, there's the cutoff. Will we have that person sitting in there explaining A versus B or C versus D, or that team is there because two guys got sick, or one of the best players on a women's team had a WD because of a wrist injury? You know what I mean? It's the minutia once you get to those maybe final 5, 10, 15 teams. And we've seen it. Squads schedule differently over the past 10 years or so to try to maybe get a little more match play experience, or the 500 rule when it comes into play. So I love your optimism that you see the light at the end of the tunnel, because I believe on this podcast in the fall, we didn't quite see that light.
The sky was kind of falling a little bit, maybe unnecessarily. So apologies there, but I do feel good about things.
Good. Well, I feel good that we've kicked off 2024. Always thrilled to have JC Well be part of it. Next week, we'll sort of do a deep dive into the conferences, what we think are some question marks for some teams or who the prohibitive favorites are. As I always feel like February, it's it. Let's get the ball rolling. We'll have some results, and then we can sort of look at the teams, the players we think should be in good positions come May, and maybe others that will come back from a little deeper in the pack. But most importantly, always good to reconnect with you, my friend, and get this new year rolling.
Yeah, no, we got tournaments are starting to come in hot and heavy here. We got the big Therese Hessian regional preview out in Palos Verdes. That kind of is always the event that kicks off at least the women's side of things. Just had Arizona's event in Tucson. We got a bunch of big heavy hitters heading out to Hawaii for the Armorari here pretty soon. It's here. It's here, Berko, and it'll be fun to watch.
Absolutely. We will cover it from top to bottom each and every week right here on College Golf Talk. Again, for those tuning in, listening, watching, however you get it, we appreciate your continued support. And for Brentley, I'm Berko. We'll do it again next week right here on College Golf Talk.